Okay, so I'm going to finish the case study on the World Wide Web, specifically the caching part of it, and then we will do two more case studies. So we are done with the most of the key topics. Okay, so since last class we started doing case studies. So first case study was the web, which I'll finish up today. We'll do two small ones today, one on enterprise Java, EJBs, and one on Corba, which fall under the distributed objects chapter of the book. Next time we'll do two more on Genie and DCOM, I think, DCOM and Genie. Okay, and then that leaves one more class, and probably that class will be a case study on cloud computing or something like that. I haven't decided what the last class should be, we'll figure that out. Okay. So we were talking about web caching. Okay. So the picture to keep in mind is you have instead of a browser and a web server, you have a browser, a proxy server and a web server. Browsers send requests to proxies which have a cache. If the data that is requested is cached, the response goes back, otherwise it's sent to the server. This works well for static HTML content, GIF images and so on. It does not work as well for dynamically generated web content. Okay, so if the server is generating the page on the fly for every request and customizing it, you can't cache the page at the proxy cache. So it may be something like the Amazon page, for instance, which is customized based on your prior shopping habits and so on. So you can't cache the home page of Amazon and give that to another user, because that user would have typically seen something else. So caches work well for static but not as well for dynamic content. That's something to keep in mind. So in the context of the cache, we started talking about consistency. I introduced the notion of a push-based model, and we were talking really about the pull-based model. Okay, so the pull-based, I was saying that this burden of consistency is on the proxy. Proxy has to pull the server to see if any pages it has cached have changed on the server. If so, it needs to fetch it. Okay? The only way to give strong guarantees in this case is to pull on every request. Okay? If you don't pull on every request, you are sort of never sure whether the actual page has changed at the server. Okay? Typically, the server might assign an expiration time to give a hint to the proxy when the page might change. It's not an absolute guarantee. Okay? If you don't check until the expiration time, the page may still change. Just a guess on the part of the server. Okay? Also mentioned is intelligent polling approach, where the frequency of polling can actually depend on the rate of change of that content. If there are pages like the CNN page that change very frequently, the proxy can cache the page but also poll the server frequently to fetch the latest content. If there are pages that don't change frequently, the proxy can then poll less frequently. Okay. And the proxy can determine how quickly the page is changing, how frequently it's changing, and adjust its polling frequency dynamically. You don't have to tell the proxy that this page is going to change frequently or not. It can just figure this out based on what it's actually seeing. When it polls if the page has changed, it knows the time that fetched it last time, the time it fetched now, knows it has changed at least once in these two periods. So it knows how quickly it is changing. Okay? So in other words, this is adaptive. It does not require knowledge of how the update rates of objects. It can adapt. If pages start with are changing quickly and are popular, it can adapt the polling frequency. Okay, so the important thing is it can be implemented using simple HTTP. No additional protocol is needed. We just use conditional GET messages. Server is stateless. Server is simple. All the burden of consistency is at the proxy. It is resilient to failures because there is no state being maintained. Okay, unlike the push approach where you are actually keeping track of which proxies had what pages, no such state is maintained here. Okay? The disadvantage is consistency guarantees are typically weaker, and it puts more burden on the proxies. Okay? So now I will talk about a hybrid approach called leases. Okay? Leases are a concept that are used widely in distributed systems. Okay? Although we have actually finished through most of the content of the book, we actually did not look at leases in detail. Okay? This is something that used in other contexts as well. I will introduce this in the context of web caching. Okay? So lease is basically a contract, okay, as the name suggests. It's a contract between two entities, typically a proxy and a server, or a server and a client, doesn't matter what it is. It's a contract and it has a time period associated with it. Okay, just as you sign a lease for an apartment, is the same kind of thing. You agree into a contract and there's a time period specified. And the contract basically is for something. Okay, and that contract is valid for that time period. Okay, when the lease expires, the contract expires and then the two entities can do whatever they want. But once they've agreed on a lease, they have to agree to the conditions of the lease. Okay. Now in the context of web caching, the lease is between a proxy and the server. And it's a contract where the server agrees to notify the proxy of any changes to a page so long as the lease is valid. Okay, so you get a lease for a page and the lease, and you tell the server, I want a lease for this page. And the server might grant you a lease for a certain duration, 1 hour, 6 hours. And for that duration, the server agrees to send you notifications or invalidates so long as the page changes. Okay. Once the lease expires, the server does not, can stop sending notifications to the proxy. So it is, in some sense, a server push approach with the expiration time which is defined by the lease. Okay, so then the proxy can decide once the lease expires if it is no longer interested in the page. If nobody is accessing it, it does not have to get a new lease. Okay, but if the web page is popular at that cache, then it can get a new lease saying, okay, I want to renew it and keep sending me updates or invalidates because I would like to keep the content fresh. Right? Now the interesting thing about the lease is that you have to pick the duration carefully, and depending on the duration, you can give actually go between a pull based approach and a push based approach. If you have zero duration leases, this is effectively polling because you don't get a lease at all. The client has to go back and poll the server. Okay? If you have infinite duration lease, which means the lease never expires, you are back to a pure server push approach, where once you get the page, the server has committed forever to sending you notifications whenever the page changes. Okay, and the server has to keep state forever. And in typically the lease duration will be somewhere between zero and infinity. So you control how much of the burden is on the proxy and how much of the burden is on the server. Okay. So this is typically how leases would work. I thought this was an animation, but maybe not. So a client sends a read request trying to fetch a web page, it sends it to the proxy. Okay? Initially the proxy may not have it in the cache, so it's a cache miss. So it sends off an HTTP request, which is a GET request to the server saying give me this page, and also says give me a lease with this page. Okay? So server sends back the page and sends a lease. Okay? The lease, as is shown here, has a duration associated with it. Okay? Now the server has kept state of this proxy. It knows the proxy has fetched this page and it has committed to sending any changes to the page and notifications or changes to the page to the proxy until the lease expires. So invalidates and updates or updates keep coming so long as the lease is valid. Once the lease expires, the proxy has to decide whether it wants to fetch a new lease or just leave it expired and just throw away the contents from its cache. So it's up to the proxy at this point. So some of the burden is on the server. The burden of whether to renew leases or which leases to renew is on the proxy. Okay, so this is sort of balances where the burden of cache consistency lies. The important thing is here, so long as you have a lease, you are guaranteed that whatever is in your cache is up to date. Okay, because if it would have changed, the server would have to has committed to sending you a notification immediately. Okay, is this clear? So leases are used in a variety of caching contexts in similar ways. So in a distributed file system, for instance, if a client is caching a file that is on the server, it can do the exact same thing. It can get a lease because it has to implement a cache consistency protocol. If some other client starts writing to the file at the server, then whatever you have, whatever you have cached is not valid. Okay? So you could get a lease for the exact same purpose, saying, let me know if the file is written to by some other client within the distributed system. Okay? So this is not something that was designed just for the web. The point to keep in mind is leases are used in other contexts as well. Okay? Now big question for the server is how to decide the duration of the lease. Okay? So there are a variety of policies that have been designed. So you can do an age-based lease. Okay? Age-based lease says you decide the duration of the lease based on the age of the object. The age of the object is the time since the last modification. How long has this object lived since it was modified last? Okay, that's the age of the object. So you can basically give longer leases, for instance, to objects that are changing frequently or not changing frequently, depending on what the policy is, and less frequent ones to objects that are not changing. Okay, so you can decide it based on the age, you can decide it based on the popularity of objects. Okay? You can have shorter leases for more popular objects, because if the object is more popular, there will be lots of proxies that might cache it. Okay? So you have to keep more state for this one web page, because there will be lots of proxies. So if you have shorter leases, the state expires quickly and you can throw it away. Okay? So that will reduce the burden of state maintenance at the server. Okay? You can also do load-based leases. Okay? You can check the load on the server itself, and as the load grows, you can give shorter leases. Okay? Because higher the load, the more work you have to do. Okay? So you can decide the duration of a lease based on a variety of parameters. Okay? You can choose it statically, of course, that's the simplest policy. Or you can dynamically choose it based on what the age of the object is, how popular it is, or what the load on the system is. Okay. So that is cache consistency between one proxy and one server. Okay. Typically in any system you will have lots of proxies and some number of servers. Let's assume there is still one server, but the content from the server may be cached at multiple proxies. Okay. Now this will yield some interesting optimizations called cooperative caching. Okay. So in this case what happens is, if you go back to the previous picture that I had shown. Okay. So here we have one proxy, one server, but there will be lots of proxies that may be caching content. So when request from a browser arrives at this proxy, if the request happens to be a cache miss, okay, in this scenario you go to the server and fetch the web page because you don't have it in the cache. Okay. In the cooperative caching approach, what happens is the proxy can go to a nearby proxy to fetch that content rather than going to the server. Okay. In other words, caches are cooperating with one another. Okay, they share their own caches with other proxies so that you may not have to go to the server. Okay? This further reduces the burden on the server. So whenever you have a cache miss, you can ask nearby proxy saying, do you have this page? And only if nobody in your vicinity has this page, and neither do you go to the server. Okay? So this is called cooperative caching. So I'll show. Okay, so proxies, so what happens typically in this case is you have a hierarchy of proxies. It's an overlay network of proxies, and this is often used in the context of a content distribution network. Okay? So you have a large number of proxies that have been deployed out there to distribute content from websites, popular websites, to browsers, okay, from users. And then the proxies themselves cooperate, and you only go to the server when there is no alternative. So here is a picture of how something like this may work. So this is a one level tree of proxies. Okay, there is one root proxy and there are three leaf proxies. Okay, this is a simple tree, and that's the origin server. Okay, these four servers are caching content, four proxies rather are caching content from the origin servers, and these are all end users. Okay, these are two examples of systems. Squid is an open source web proxy that uses this kind of mechanism, and Harvest is another one. Okay, so here is a read that has come. Okay, this is a read for web page A that comes to this proxy. Let's assume it's a miss. Okay, so you send messages to your children and you send a message to your parent in the tree saying, do you have this web page? Okay, messages are labeled ICP, which stands for Internet Caching Protocol. Okay, that's a protocol that was designed that does it. So you send a, basically it's equivalent of a HTTP GET, saying, do you have this page? Okay, so assume that they all respond saying they don't have it. Okay, so none of them, the page, first time the page has been requested in the whole system, so you get back these messages. So then what happens is the request from the user is forwarded to the parent. Okay, the parent repeats this process. If this was a multi-level tree, the parent would have sent this ICP message to its peers and its parent, and so on until it reaches the root. In this case, there is nothing to do because it's at the root. The root knows that it doesn't have it, so it will just go to the server and send that HTTP request to the server. The page will come back here and then it will trickle down the tree. Okay, so it will come down to the tree to this cache, and then that will send that back to the browser. Okay. Now the page has not only gone back to the browser, but it's now cached here and it's cached here. Okay, it's basically cached along the path from the leaf all the way to the root. Okay, so if somebody else, if this browser were to request it here, you would basically broadcast it and in this subtree, and you would get it from this subtree. You wouldn't have to go back to the server. Okay, is that clear? Okay. So one disadvantage. So you will. So the advantage of this approach is that if any proxy in the vicinity has a copy of the web page, you don't have to go to the server. Okay. It could be a local miss, but it could be a remote hit, meaning that some remote proxy actually services it. You don't have to have what is called a global miss, which is nobody has it, so I have to go to a server. Okay, that's an advantage. The disadvantage is if you have nobody has it, you have all these steps you have to perform. Okay, you are broadcasting this, you are getting back responses, the request is trickling up the tree all the way until it hits the root, and then you go and get it from the server and then you give it back to the browser. Okay. As you can imagine, this is going to incur some latency. Okay, so the first time a web page is accessed anywhere in the system, this browser here is going to see very slow performance, because there are lots of requests that are getting, messages that are getting exchanged before the page is actually fetched. It would have been faster for this browser probably to go to the server directly. Okay. So global misses are slow in this system. Okay. But otherwise, once the page is cached somewhere, you can go and get it fairly quickly. Okay. So here is another system that tries to optimize this for this problem. Okay. So what you want is a scenario where you not only service cache hits quickly, you don't slow down requests that are global misses. In the previous scenario, which is hierarchical caches, global misses were slow. Okay, you had to actually let the request trickle up the tree before you could service it. So here is another example that tries to optimize it. Okay, so what happens here in this case is you try to eliminate the broadcast, the ICP broadcast request that you saw here, where you have to ask all of the proxies in the vicinity, what do you have? Okay. The way you eliminate it is you create a table beforehand which tells you what is cached at other proxies nearby. Okay, so every time a page is fetched into the cache, you let your nearby proxies know I have this page in my cache. So each proxy not only knows what is in its own cache, it has a table that tells it what is in someone else's cache nearby. Okay. So when a request comes, all it has to do, okay, in the next slide, all it has to do is do a local table lookup. Do I have it in my cache? Does anyone else has it in their caches? Okay. If the answer is no, then there's no reason to send it up the tree. You just go back to the server and fetch it directly. Okay. So global misses are just a local table lookup, and if the table lookup says it's not there anywhere close by, you just go to the server. Okay, so this does not slow down global misses. So browsers still see good performance the first time you are accessing an object. Okay, and hits are just as fast, because when you do a table lookup, you know what is there in your cache and someone else's cache. And if you know that it's in someone else's cache, you can go and access it. Okay, the only disadvantage of this approach is that this table has to be kept up to date as objects are being brought in and evicted from caches. Okay. So if you do this periodically, let's say you send updates to other proxies every 5 minutes. Okay, every 5 minutes you keep track of all the objects that you have fetched and all the objects that you have deleted, you batch all of these pages and then you send it up. So everybody's tables get updated. But for that 5 minute duration, everybody else has a slightly approximate view of what is in your cache. In particular, you may have deleted some object to make room for a new object, and everyone else still thinks you have it cached. Okay. So now if somebody else requests it and that table says it is in this proxy's cache, you send that request, it may still be a miss, because this proxy thought you had it, but you have evicted it. Okay. And that can be simply handled by that proxy then says this was a mistake, so I'll get it from the server and give it to you. So you might have a miss with at most two hops, because you have a wrong hint in your table which tells somebody else nearby has it, but they don't. They just evicted it from their cache. Okay. But so long as the table is accurate, hits are at most two hops. Okay. Misses are at most two hops, and lookups are local.
Why is
it
hit two hops? Isn't it instantaneous?
A hit is two hops because one hop is from the proxy to this cache, and if this cache doesn't have it, but let's say this cache has it, then you have to go an extra hop to fetch it from that cache. Okay, it could be one hop if it has it here, but there may be a second hop to get it from a nearby proxy. Okay, misses are at most two hops, because if nobody else has it, in one hop you go to the server, fetch it, If you think somebody has it, then you go there, but it was a wrong guess, then that proxy has to get it for you. Okay, so that's the advantage. So you taken a hierarchical system and you may have flattened it by keeping these tables. Okay, so here are some animations that show how this works. So you basically, so this is the table that says web page A is at node X, which is cached here. Okay. So when this browser actually asks for page of A, you do this table lookup. Okay. And then you go get that page from there, and then you're done. Okay. So here is another example where you try to read object B from this node. There is no entry for B in the table, so you just go to the server. This is a global miss. Okay. Your table says nobody has it. You go get it, and you bring it. Okay. So at this point, okay, when you have gotten B, okay, your table, you have to then notify other proxies nearby. Okay, soon thereafter, saying you have fetched B, so they can update their directories, saying now this is cached at this node. Okay, that's an additional overhead of this technique for proxies. Okay, so these kinds of groups of clusters of proxies are also referred to as a content distribution network. Okay, so they are distributing content from web servers out to end users. And there are content distribution networks that can be fairly large or global in scope. Okay. There is a company called Akamai that has 10-20,000 proxies that they are deployed globally. Okay. So what Akamai does is whenever a browser tries to make a request to for a web page, it uses a DNS mechanism to forward that request to a nearby proxy. Yes, and then so it figures out where this request came from, and then it says, okay, here is a proxy close by that might have cached this content, so go fetch it from that proxy. So it basically, so browsers don't have to figure out what is the closest proxy to approach. So you just do a DNS lookup as you would have done normally to see where the web page, the server is, and the system actually points you to a nearby proxy. So I showed an example of this when we did this DNS chapter. If you remember, I can show that again if you want. So if you actually do, I think that was Intel or something like this. So if you go and actually in your browser try to go to intel.com, your browser is going to do a DNS lookup. Okay? So you see that intel.com, okay, actually is an alias for this proxy that is called akamai.net. Meaning that content from there is cached in this Akamai's content distribution network. More importantly, the DNS lookup has given you that address 128.119.166 something. Okay, that's an address in the UMass domain. Okay, so to actually go to the Intel web page, all you have to do is your browser is transparently going to go to this machine because it thinks that Intel.com is this server. Okay, browser doesn't even need to know. It just goes to this machine, which is a cache somewhere in the UMass domain, and it actually that content is probably cached there. So you just get all the web pages from there. Okay. So and because the load balancer is in the dispatcher is in the DNS, the system can intelligently send you not only to a close by proxy, but if this proxy did not have intel.com, but maybe something in the Phi College has had it, you could have got resolved to some other machine. So you can also keep track of who has what and redirect you accordingly.
Then DNS
is
becoming kind of like cache.
Yes, so in this case, a DNS is an intelligent system. It's not just your dumb IP address translation system. Okay, it is actually an intelligent DNS that has actually figured out where you are making the request from. Okay, and it knows where the proxies are located. It knows the load on the proxies. It might know also what content is cached, and it is sending you to the nearby proxy. So it can do all of these table lookups that were mentioned. Based on your location, the DNS will do this lookup and send you off somewhere. Okay. So yes, the DNS mechanism becomes more complicated. Okay. So the other thing that I did not mention here is content distribution networks make the problem of cache consistency somewhat simpler, okay, from a server perspective. Because what could happen is the root of the the parent here, where is the only entity that is actually talking to the server. These other caches are not directly talking to the server. So only this this entity and this entity have to cooperate with one another to ensure that content is fresh. So the lease, for instance, if you implement a leasing mechanism, then for this large hierarchy of proxies, only the parent has to keep a lease with the server. Okay, and whenever any notifications are sent, the parent can multicast it out into the tree. So you can reduce the amount of state the server has to maintain. Okay, otherwise, each of these proxies would have to keep a lease with the server to keep their content fresh. Okay, you don't have to do that in a hierarchical proxy system. Only the root can participate in cache consistency. Okay, it can send updates down the tree hierarchically to whoever needs it. Okay, the root can also keep track of who has what, send all of that. So all the state maintenance can be done within the proxy system. Okay, who has what, which updates to forward down, which path should I broadcast or just send it down a particular subtree, etc. Okay, so that's something to keep in mind. This is also an active area of research, content distribution. No longer as active as it was 3-4 years ago, but there are people still looking at variety of techniques of how to organize these proxies and how to implement cache consistency and whatnot. Okay, so that is all I have. The picture somewhere. I guess I have already shown this, how the DNS works. So, let me switch gears and move on to the next case study, which is going to be on distributed objects. Okay, so, we briefly mentioned this notion of a distributed objects back when we were doing RMIs. If you remember, when I was talking about remote objects, okay, I also mentioned there that there's a notion of a distributed object where the object state itself is split across multiple machines. Okay? So now we'll come back to that concept and look at it in some more detail. Okay? So we'll do two case studies. One is of our enterprise Java beans or EJBs, and then the other one is Corba. Okay, so here's a picture that I had put up some time back on distributed object models. Okay, so this is the picture of a remote method invocation. Okay, something we have seen back in chapter 3 or 4. You have a client, you have a server, there are stubs, okay, which is called a proxy and a skeleton in object-oriented world. Okay, if the first time the client invokes a method, so this is the object, it has some data container which holds its state, it has some methods that it has exposed to the to other objects. Okay, these methods constitute the interface to access this object. Okay, so the first time the client actually accesses any method for that object, it has to first go to the stub and import the interface, and then it has to do all the usual stuff, construct a message, marshal all the arguments, send off a message to the stub, then it enters the server, it's handed off to the object invokes that method, constructs a response, then the reply goes back. A standard RMI like, not RMI, like RMI concept. Okay. So what distributed objects do, okay, so that's RPCs or RMS. So what distributed objects do is they have this remote method invocation, plus they have the ability to do distributed object references. You can send around references to other objects, because object state can be split across multiple machines, the object itself can be distributed, and so on. Okay. So on the server side, you have to create an object, you have to register it with a name service, like in the normal case, and in the client side you get a reference to the object. Okay, this is a network pointer to the object. Okay, you can pass around this reference to other objects if you want to, and I'll show an example of a object reference which is a network pointer shortly. Okay, so you have to look up the name service, get the object reference, and once you've gotten it, you may additionally have to import the interface. Okay, and then invoke the method. So here are some examples of distributed object systems. Okay, we start with sort of the RPC world. Okay, this is not distributed objects, they are just RPCs. Then that went into the DCE model. I mentioned the distributed computing environment when we did remote methods. So this was the first time somebody actually came up with object-oriented implementation, okay, of RPCs. That led to CORBA and DCOM, okay, which has then led to EJBs. Okay. So today we look at this box in some quickly, which is CORBA, and we'll look at EJBs. Next time we will look a little bit at DCOM. Java RMIs I already mentioned when we did the RMI chapter. The vision here was that you would have this complex applications which would have a number of objects. Objects would be spread across arbitrary numbers of machines, and then any machine can then, or any object can talk to any other objects and so on and so forth. So this is what they assume these systems would be used for. Okay, but traditionally today the systems still look like that. Okay. What has happened is the server, so there's a client and the server. What has happened is the server functionality has actually gotten split across multiple machines, like in the multi-tier architecture or a replicated architecture, and objects are actually used for replication and distribution only at the server. Okay. You rarely have this kind of model where you have this very complex application that's interacting. More common is this model where this bubble actually has multiple objects and so on. Okay, so here is the notion of this remote object reference. So what this slide shows is what this network pointer to an object looks like if in the context of CORBA. So it's basically a set of fields, okay, which has variety of information. The two most important things are, so there's an identifier for the object, but then there is the host where this object resides. There's a port number that you have to use. This is the socket port number that you have to use to contact or invoke methods on that object. And there is a key for the object that allows you to access that object itself. Multiple objects may be listening at this host and this port. So this key allows you to go back to a particular object or a particular class and invoke a method on that class. Okay? So this has an identifier and some other server specific information. Okay? This is encoded in this notion of an object reference and send back to the client. So the client, when it dereferences this and invokes a method, the stub has to then look at the host and the port number, set up a connection, and then get access to that object and so on. This is what comes back to you from the naming service. When you go to the naming service, it sends back you an object reference saying, to access this method on this object, use this reference. And then you have to use the reference to or decode it to get the host information, which is an IP address. This is a port number, and this is the object ID. And in the context of CORBA, this is supposed to be independent of the platform, language, and so on. Any implementation of CORBA, no matter what the OS, no matter what the language, has to use this format. Okay, you can't change the format of this object reference or a network pointer depending on whether you have a Java implementation of CORBA or C. They all have to adhere to this standard. Okay? This makes it interoperable. So you can have a C++ implementation of CORBA object that is accessing a Java implementation of a CORBA object. Okay? Because they are both talking this CORBA, both implemented using this CORBA protocol, this is possible. Okay? Typically in an RPC system, you assume that the system uses the same language or the same platform. In CORBA, that need not be the case, okay, because they designed it to be language and platform independent. Okay. Some additional details. Initial versions of CORBA used an opaque object reference, which means that this thing was not interpretable by the client itself. You got this reference, you couldn't directly interpret it. Okay, the stub could do it, but the applications are not supposed to interpret it. Okay, more modern implementation, which include Java and CORBA 3.0, use what are called transparent object references, which the client can decode. Okay, in other words, you can actually decode this and extract all of this information and know where the object resides. If your application wants to use this, you can extract that information from the object reference. Okay, I mean, that's something to keep in mind. Okay. So we have talked about binding already. Okay. Binding to a client, an object can be either static or dynamic. Okay. In static case, you do this when you write the application. Okay. In the dynamic case, you do it at runtime. Okay. So in the dynamic case, you have the advantage of not even knowing what the object is. You can just call the method. The naming service will then locate the object for you and allow you to import it. In the static case, you at least have to have, as in the RPC system, you have to at least have the header files that tell you what are the remote methods that some process is exposed to you. Okay. So same is true in distributed objects. You can have static binding or dynamic binding, depending on whether the binding is done at or runtime or is done at application design time. Okay. So now let's talk a little bit about EJBs. With that brief background about distributed objects, here is what an EJB looks like. Okay. So what are Enterprise Java Beans? So this is basically an implementation of Java that is used for writing complex distributed applications. Okay. So it's, think of it as a middleware. Okay. So this middleware takes the standard Java and exposes a number of useful services that you can use to write distributed application. Okay. So here are variety of services. RMI is already supported in Java, okay, but that's still a service. You have a JDBC service. Okay. You have the JMS service, the Java Messaging Service, just JNDI, which I've forgotten what that even means. Okay. So you have these services, and then you have a distributed object model that's layered on top. Okay. So just as in Corba does exactly the same thing. It is basically a large distributed middleware platform, okay, that provides a number of useful services to you. Okay. And Corba has made 24 services. We'll look at that a little later. And you can use the services to write your application. So you might have a locking service, for instance, a distributed lock implementation. So now if you want to do some transaction and you want to get locks, you just go to the locking service, you instantiate a new lock, it will take care of all of the details. Okay. You can have messaging service which will allow you to send messages which are stored in buffer. So it could be like a message queuing system. Okay. So all of these services are like libraries that you can make use of to write complex distributed applications. So this is Java's implementation of a middleware for writing distributed applications. So that's what is basically what EJBs do. Okay. So the way you use EJBs is very similar to way you do any distributed objects. Okay. All your application has to be written as objects or classes. You can create classes, you can create object, delete objects. There is notion of persistent objects, which I'll come to in just one moment. Okay. And then that's the home interface, so creation, deletion, and then you expose these methods. And the remote interface allows other applications or other objects to access these services, okay, or EJBs. So if you think about this multi-tier application, the way EJBs work is you have this HTTP tier, okay, which does HTTP processing. You write the application itself in Java, or rather using EJB. So you have an EJB server running here that is running your code, and then you have the last tier is your DB tier, database tier, which is where all the data resides. Okay. So most complex applications will be written in this fashion. Yeah, so e-commerce stores, for instance, all the store functionality is written in Java using all these EJB services, libraries and objects. And that is the middle tier of your typical application. Okay. So requests come as HTTP, they are processed here, and you send it off to the EJB tier. It does whatever you are asking it to do, search on keywords or buy an object, put it in the cart, whatever, or provide credit card details. All of that is handled. The code for that resides here. It's written in EJBs. And then the database has the catalog and information, what customers and whatnot. Okay. Now typically, in addition to these services, there are four types of objects. The objects here are called beans. Okay. So there are four types of objects you can create. Okay. There is a stateless object, there is a stateful object, there is a persistent object, and there is a message-driven object. Okay. So the stateless beans are objects that you can create where this object does not need to create any store any state. Okay. So you can just create it, it does some computation, it returns back a result. There is no state associated with that object. Okay? If you want to keep state, then you create what is called a stateful session bean. Okay? So typically if you have a shopping cart or something like this, where you have to keep track of what the customer has put in the shopping cart, you would actually use a stateful bean. Okay? Because that is state for that particular object, there is a session that is created. So the object lives for the duration of the session, and it keeps state what the customer has done, for instance. Entity beans are persistent objects. These are objects whose state is actually stored on disk, not in memory. Okay, so this also has state, but this state does not go away if your application is rebooted. this state is going to go away if the application is rebooted. This state is stored in RAM, this state is stored on disk. Okay? So you can have an entity being that stores, let's say, customer profile. So you create a profile for a customer, username, address, all of this. It could be made into an entity bean. So you just create an object. You don't have to deal with storing it on disk. Java or EJBs will automatically store the state on disk. And you can update it. You can, whenever you modify the state, it's all persisted on disk. Okay? And then there are messaging beans. So these are used for publish subscribe type application. Okay, so these are used for sending messages, can subscribe to certain type of events. We'll talk about the same concept in the context of Java, Korba, in the context of its event service in a few slides. Okay, but the same thing is available even in the case of EJBs. Okay, so that's a very brief 3 or 4 slide introduction to EJBs. Same concepts are true also for Korba. So Korba is also middleware like EJBs. It was designed for the very same purpose, saying people are writing complex distributed application. The same kind of functionality is necessary for a variety of different applications. So let's implement that in a middleware. So now if you want to write an application, you just call the right services, use the right type of objects. A lot of functionality is built for you in this middleware. Okay? And the core of Korba is what is called an ORB, or an object request broker. This is the common mechanism that anything in Korba uses to communicate with anything else. Okay, so there are services here. Okay, these facilities are actually services. There are other types of services. Services, they all talk to each other using this ORB interface. Okay, object request broker interface, which is just an interface for one object to talk to another object. That's called an ORB. So this is now was designed as a standard by this organization called OMG, Object Management Group. It was a very active area for doing distributed systems work maybe 10 years ago. Okay? Today you barely hear of Korba, okay? Because basically it has been a commercial failure. EJBs, on the other hand, has been very successful. There are lots of enterprise applications that are using EJBs, but not very many that use Korba. There are one or two. But that was basically where a lot of the concept that even EJBs implement were first bought. Okay, this is sort of the first large middleware framework. Okay, so I already mentioned the ORB, it's the core of the middleware platform. It handles communication within objects and clients. It's implemented as libraries. So let's look at some of those boxes a little more detail. So here is the object model. Okay? It looks very similar to any other distributed object model. Okay? Your stub is basically the ORB itself. So at the client, at the server, the ORB implements the stub. It has an interface, and there is this IDL proxy that allows you to write new methods and whatnot. Okay? The server looks a little more complicated. The skeleton is the interface. Okay. So there's a dynamic skeleton interface which allows you to extend these methods on the fly. You can add new methods on the fly. There's the same ORB interface. I'll talk about the object adapter. Okay. Very similar concept. You have an IDL language where you specify all the objects. You use a compiler. It generates some header files and other files that you link to in your application. Okay. Versions of Korba are typically use C++ because this predated Java. EJBs are obviously all based on Java, but most Korba implementations are actually C++ based. Okay. So let me talk a little bit about the services. So you will see here are some standard services that Korba provides. You can look at many of them. There's a query service. So if you want to implement a simple query on some data, you can use the query service. It's a lightweight database-like service that is already implemented. You don't have to do anything. There's a concurrency service. Okay, so if you use the concurrency service, every request or method that comes into the object, automatically the system creates a new thread. That thread is going to handle the request, and then when the request is done, the thread goes away. Okay, already pre-built. Transactional service. So you can implement the notion of a transaction. Okay, if you want to encapsulate something into a transaction, just use the transactional service. Okay, we'll talk about the event service in more detail. It's the only one we look at, really. There is externalization, which is using in different international languages. Here is a licensing service. If this is a piece of software, You can use the licensing service to make sure any request that comes in from any other machine actually has a license. They purchase a software license to access it. Okay. So variety of things that you wouldn't even think of. There's a time service. I don't know why it has a time service, but it does. Okay, which implements time synchronization. Okay. Here's the persistent service that's very similar to the entity bean. Okay. So we use the persistent service and create an object. That object state is actually stored on disk. Okay. So when the machine reboots, you can just load it back from disk and you get the object back. Okay. So very similar things. Okay. So I already mentioned all of this. So there are, just like in RPCs, CORBA also supports variety of invocation models. The typical one is synchronous. Okay, this is your standard blocking call. You call a RMI, do an RMI, it blocks until you get back a response. Okay? You also have the one-way and the deferred synchronous. We looked at all of this when we did our RPCs and RMS. You can send a one-way request, you can send deferred synchronous request. And here are the failure semantics are also specified. For synchronous, it's at most one semantics. If you get back a request, response rather, you know that the object method was invoked at most once. One way is best effort, and deferred synchronous is also at most once. Okay, so all this is pre-specified. So any implementation of CORBA has to satisfy those semantics, which means you have to do certain things when failures occur. Yes.
What does best effort delivery mean?
Best effort delivery just says that you will not wait for an ACK because it is one way. It's presumably it is based on UDP. You construct your RPC request using UDP. The initial RPC implementations were also UDP based. You send it off one way and you don't wait for an acknowledgement. You don't retransmit if the message is lost. That's a best effort one way RPC request. That's the way to think about it. Sent over UDP. So if the message is lost, the request is never serviced at the server.
So why is that best effort? Isn't that just once,
why is that best effort?
It's not trying to retransmit or anything.
If you think of it, it is at most once. But the important thing here is that these two will involve retransmissions and whatnot. This will not. That's all it is trying to say. Okay. Okay, so one can ask why did EJBs become successful but CORBA did not. Okay. Clearly, one way to think about it is CORBA was the first middleware platform. I think they made it needlessly more complicated than it had to be. Okay. When you have very complex systems, application programmers don't necessarily like it. Okay. But it came up with lots of these concepts. All this notion of services, the way to write middleware. So, lot of those concepts have been implemented in EJB. So, in one way to think about it is EJBs are sort of the next generation of middleware platform that are just reusing the concepts that were designed for CORBA. So, in that sense, the ideas live on. The system itself does not. There is at least one popular implementation that does use CORBA. The GNOME desktop on Linux is CORBA based. Okay, so GNOME actually uses a very lightweight implementation of CORBA for coordination between components of the GNOME desktop and talking across machines and whatnot. So we actually look at the console or error logs, and sometimes GNOME actually prints something, you see some CORBA messages. Okay, occasionally this shows up. Right. So that's the only sort of very popular application. There are some niche ones that do use it, but this is probably the only one that is really very popular. There are some embedded implementations, but again, not very popular. Okay. And the reason I guess it has failed is that it was designed by a committee, okay, which is almost always not a good idea. Standards that work are something that have actually become popular first, which are called de facto standards, and then get standardized, saying now that it is popular, let's write a protocol everybody agrees on. If it's the other way around, saying let's have a committee that will first come up with a spec and then everyone goes and implement it, that almost never works. Same thing happened with the ISO network protocol stack. The 7-layer protocol stack that you see in the textbook, which is your ISO standard, is not implemented. TCP is what actually works. TCP was something that was not designed by committee. It happened to become popular, and that is what is the de facto standard. So this basically suffered from this notion of designing by committee, where all these corporations got together, nobody agreed with anything, so everything was all consensus based, so it became more complex than it needed to be. Which is always a recipe for failure. EJBs, on the other hand, I think Sun basically drove the show and they designed it, and then later on others contributed to it, but it was more successful. So the one service, that the only service of CORBA that we will look at, is the event notification service. So think of this as a publish subscribe service. So each of these publishers and subscribers, which are suppliers, which are the producers and consumers, are essentially objects. And they communicate with one another, not directly using method invocations, but by publishing and subscribing to events. And the event service is already there to help you with this. So all you have to do is use the event service and say, I want what is called a new event channel. That's your buffer or a queue. And any supplier or producer can publish events. Consumers subscribe to certain types of events, and when those events are published, then they are notified that here is a new event or here is a new date. So data can be exchanged in this fashion, other forms of information can be exchanged in this fashion. This is a standard publish subscribe paradigm. In CORBA you can write this publish subscribe application very simply, because all of the underlying mechanisms to write the event channel, to publish subscribe filter, all this is built for you by the event service. Here this picture is showing you the push based publish subscribe paradigm, where events are pushed or published by suppliers to the event channel. The event channel pushes these events to the consumers. You can also get pull based event channels. So here consumers are polling, is there a new event that I care about? You periodically poll the event channel. This is basically a queue. Every time you poll, this entity will check, is there a new event that has been published. And the event channel itself polls the suppliers, then do you have a new event. So this is a pure pull based implementation. Okay, so you can use either push or pull depending on whatever works for your application. Okay, so one more point I want to mention is the asynchronous method invocation. Okay, typically your RMI methods or RPCs are synchronous. As I was pointing out, CORBA implements a variety of these models: asynchronous, deferred synchronous, one way. So here is how asynchronous works. You make a RPC request or an RMI request, it goes off to the server. And the client can then, is non-blocking, it will continue execution. The response is actually going to come back from the server. So if there is a thread in the ORB that is waiting for the request, the client itself does not block. Client continues execution, so the response comes back. At this point the client has a callback interface. The ORB actually uses the callback interface to notify the client saying your response for the RPC has come back. This will trigger typically a signal in the application. So then you have to go into the callback, which is interface, which is your signal handler, and take delivery of whatever response came back for this RPC request. This is how you would implement a asynchronous RPC method using CORBA. And you can also have polling based asynchronous mechanisms, where the previous one was notify, this one is using poll. You sent off a request, and then the client will periodically poll. There is no asynchronous notification. You go and poll saying, has the response come? This is a non-blocking poll. So periodically you poll, and at some later point a response does come, and then when you poll subsequently you will be told that your reply has arrived from the server. So you can either be notified or you can be polled. Very similar to the message queuing systems, which both have a notify and a poll method, which was also something I had asked on the midterm, if you recall. So the same concepts are true even here. The last point that I want to talk about is this notion of a portable object adapter. So what this is basically a wrapper. So the CORBA people what they tried to do was to say, okay, there are lots of legacy applications that are out there, okay, that will not expose a CORBA interface. Okay? So if you now write new applications, how should these new CORBA objects access legacy services? So to do this, they said, let's write these wrapper methods that will somehow take legacy code and make them look like CORBA objects. Okay, so basically it's an interface that takes a legacy application. So think of it as like you have something like HTTP. You can write this wrapper on an HTTP server that allows you to access an HTTP service using a CORBA method invocation. Okay, so you will send a GET as a GET method, and then this GET method will actually be sent over HTTP and so on. So you have this notion of object adapters. They are basically nothing but wrapper code. Okay? So the objective was to allow you to access legacy applications using CORBA interfaces. So there's more interoperability. Otherwise you have to write a lot of glue code. Okay, so they actually standardized this glue code using this notion of object adapters. So that's something to keep in mind. This is just showing an internal implementation of how CORBA does this. In this case, each of this is some legacy code. It's called a servant. And there is a table here which has a map from each, which exposes an object interface. So when you call a method here, this translates it and calls some service within the servant. Okay? So in the second case, your portable object adapter has very multiple wrappers for the same code. Okay, here you have one wrapper for each piece of code. You have multiple wrappers that might expose different type of interfaces. They all point to the same piece of code internally. Okay, that's all that is showing there. So here is a snippet that says how do you turn C++ objects into CORBA objects. Okay, so here is your object. You declare a C++ object. You create what's called a new servant. Okay, and then you just call register this thing, call the PO and register the C++ object as a CORBA object. So it is done in a way that simplifies how you will write this wrapper code. Just have to declare a type of C++ object, CORBA objects, and bind the two. Okay, or link the two and register them. Okay, and then you can call methods in one and they will be translated and called as methods in the other. Okay, all that is also provided for you. Okay, so I am going to stop here. And all this is not very important, interesting from our perspective. So let me stop, and I do have the midterm I'm going to have.